Hollywood is rated LGBT radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Tonight, we have, we're just having a good old chat between the esteemed journalist, Brody Levesque, and myself. True confession time. This week was Donald Trump's State of the Union address, and I will admit it, I cannot stand to hear the man talk. I have had it. I've listened. I've tried. But I just cannot do it. Luckily, I have in my court the aforementioned esteemed journalist, Brody Levesque, whose job it is to sit through things like that so he can tell us all what was said and boil it down and in a much more palatable way than actually having to listen to the man speak. So if that sounds a little biased, sorry about that. Of course, what do you expect on a show that is titled, As Trump Vows to End HIV, Others Tell His Trans Ban to Fuck Off? So, So if you're a Trump supporter, sit back and enjoy our show tonight. And if you're not, really sit back and enjoy our show tonight. We will be talking about things like Trump's ban or vow to end HIV. Goodness knows how he plans to do that when he has Mike Pence sitting at his side, who will probably not let anything happen in terms of HIV education or anything that is truly productive in any kind of effort that would end HIV. Plus, others in the military and other and lawmakers are doing everything they can to make the Trump quote-unquote trans ban complete non-starter before it ever has a chance of getting started. And we're going to talk about some of those efforts. Plus, we have some interesting things in the transgender world happening from a program that the Biden Foundation is supporting for families. And we have an intersex young person who is fighting to have quote-unquote corrective surgery on newborns stopped when they are born intersex. So lots of stuff to talk about tonight. And with that, I will bring on my main talker-in-chief, Brody Levesque. Good evening, Brody.
Okay, good evening, Rob, and good evening to our listenership. And boy, has this been a week. I mean, between the State of the Union address and the situation in Virginia continuing to blow up and get worse, we've had plenty of things to do. Yeah, it's just been... it's been one of those weeks where you just kind of go, really, seriously, this can't be happening. This is not my life, you know?
Yeah, well, so, since you brought it up, let's get an overview of the Virginia thing. What's going on there?
As you know, we had a situation evolve last weekend where the governor of Virginia – in his medical school yearbook had appeared in blackface, okay? And then first he apologized for it, then he didn't apologize for it, and then it was him, then it wasn't him, and, you know, calls for his resignation were coming from both of Virginia's senators who happened to also be former governors of the state. There were calls from virtually every announced presidential Democratic candidate, and then he dug his heels in and said, I'm not going to be doing this. Well, while that was happening, the lieutenant governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia was accused of sexual assault. And that didn't go over too well. And then in a private meeting, which was reported on Monday, the lieutenant governor basically said words to the effect of, fuck that bitch. And, of course, this was duly reported, and that kind of made things even better. Well, we're not done. It continues. So 2 days after this, while the lieutenant governor is trying to field accusations of sexual harassment and calls for his resignation, the next part of the problem comes in. The third in line to Virginia's leadership is the state attorney general, Mark Herring, who announces that he had done blackface too. Okay. Then today we learn the fourth in line to the governorship, this time a Republican and a senior state senator, you guessed it, blackface. So most most of the memes I've seen this week on my Twitter feed have revolved around train wrecks and dumpster fires. So that's really the state of the Commonwealth right now. Honestly, no one's really sure. The governor has dug his heels in. The lady who made the accusation about the lieutenant governor after that rather lovely, you know, statement that came out on Twitter and reported by NBC News went public. Okay, so here you have a bona fide, you know, female saying, no, I'm not having that. And then, of course, this is followed by the attorney general. There are people that are saying that the AG is actually contrite. He's had meetings with leadership. But the governor's still not backing away from his position of he's trying to ride this out and kind of say, hey, you know, well, you know, wasn't me and this sort of thing and blah, blah, blah. So it's just become ridiculous, quite frankly. So right now, you know, the Commonwealth of Virginia's top three executives are in scandal. And now the one person in the Virginia Senate and General Assembly who would be the likely person to take the reins of government, yeah, him too. So, you know, now I want to note this for our listeners, with the exception of the lieutenant governor. The governor, the attorney general, and the state senator are all about the same age. So we're talking these incidences took place over 40 years ago or over 35 years ago when they were, you know, young men in the 1970s and 80s. So contextually, okay, it was a different time. I'm not excusing their behavior. It is inexcusable. It is racist. But unfortunately, the American nation has been on a learning curve. I can remember as a little boy, and we would be driving from our home in Ontario, Canada, down to Old Mexico, and as we would pass through Arizona, one of the last places we would stop was a restaurant called Sambo's on the border in Nogales, okay? And the mascot of this particular restaurant was a particularly offensive depiction of an African-American replete with big, huge eyes, big, huge lips, and it was really pretty bad. You know, racism.
Well, actually, it was,
you know,
yeah,
institutionalized.
Actually,
you know, I mean,
the thing with Sambo, because I was raised with the book that the restaurant was
based on,
and the book was called the book was called Little Black Sambo, and Sambo wasn't actually African American; he was African. It was about him in Africa, and it was you know, it portrayed him as a native in Africa, and the story went that a tiger came into his village, and he chased the tiger around the fire, and the tiger went so fast that it turned into butter. And then the butter was on pancakes. So, I mean, the gist of it. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know, you know, I'm not sure what there was particularly racist per se, other than that, I mean, that was depicting a story about, a fanciful, ridiculous story, but nothing derogatory per se, of, Native culture in Africa.
Well, again, in my later years as a journalist, when I was a little kid, it didn't one way or the other. But in my later years, as I became a journalist, someone took offense to that. It was right up there with the offensive racist term that's often used for the little jockey horseman that you would see, the little cat.
Right.
And the term that was coined out of that was porch monkeys, which is an extremely derogatory thing to say about a black person. And apparently that the Sambo thing had kind of bled over. Anyway, at the end of the day, the entire government of the Commonwealth of Virginia has managed to basically dig itself a pretty big hole. So it's like, the governor's not, answering the calls for his resignation. There's continuing protests. Now you've got the Republican leader in trouble. The attorney general's up in the air. The lieutenant governor, like I said, my entire week of memes on Twitter feeds have been nothing but train records and dumpster fires. And you know what, Rob? I'm kind of inclined to agree at this point.
I'm a little overwhelmed by a lot of it because there are no parameters. It's just this ongoing thing of tabooism that keeps coming up. And there are lines that are really obvious that we can say, that is really bad. That is bad. We reject that. Going back to what we were just talking about Little Black Sambo and Sambo's restaurant. The issue with the Sambo restaurant, in my opinion, became the fact that here, this story that was based on, a very comic book level telling of African Native culture became applied to people in this country who were African American, who had nothing to do with Native culture, and being called Little Black Sambo when they were full-fledged American, Joe Schmoes, and that's where it became synonymous with being something derogatory, and I guess that's where it gets a little fuzzy as to where something is culturally expressive versus being, a derogatory taboo. And,
I don't disagree with that. I think you're right. But the problem is, and this was illustrated by some of the remarks that I was hearing from people, in organizations like the NAACP, the American Civil Liberties Union, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Center for Justice down in Montgomery, which, as you know, opened up a new museum for lynching, is that there does come a point where you have to kind of stop and move forward. And that if that requires collateral damage, which in this case would be the top four officials of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I'm not exactly sure who would get the top job after that, but the argument I'm hearing is that maybe it is time that American politics clean themselves up to the point and does that. Now, I've got to note this part of it, though. The dichotomy of this is the hypocrisy of the right. And I'm not aiming at, in this case, Virginia so much as Stephen King of Iowa and a very well-publicized, group of nonsense to go with him and some overtly racist things. So I think what's happened is it's becoming a talking point. It's becoming a wake-up point. And we're seeing it represented in different ways. As you know, Representative Cortez of New York, who is of Latina extraction, has also had her fair share of rather nasty things said about her as recently as the State of the Union address. So I think this is all part and parcel of, quite frankly, a much larger conversation that really needs to take place. I think it's also a conversation that the LGBTQ community needs to have with itself. And, you know, because we, unfortunately, you know, aren't born in the cabbage patch, and we're not, you know, it's not mutually exclusive with us either. Racism is very much a problem. So I think it is a conversation that really needs to be had. I just am kind of, like I said, I agree with the memes. It's a dumpster fire and a train wreck. I'm not entirely sure how they're going to fix that mess, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah, I get verklempt over this because, you know, it is where the whole racism conversation is going, and you're talking about something that I can't say that the picture with the Ku Klux Klan and, you know, the blackface, you know, wasn't, there were disturbing elements about that to me on a couple of levels of making fun of something that, I mean, would we be laughing if it was a Hitler in a costume with somebody dressed in the, extermination camp garb? Would anybody find that humorous? Which obviously they were, you know, not just in blackface, but they were essentially poking fun at American terrorism. You know, so
the problem you get with that, though, is a very senior reporter who ironically works for the official state information service for the state of North Carolina, after the situation in Virginia hit the news, he started trolling through yearbooks going back into the 70s for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And in one of those yearbooks in 1979, he came across on a fraternity page, fraternity brothers in Ku Klux Klan robes and a fraternity brother in blackface with a rope around his neck. So obviously, guess what that did? That set off, you know, now in North Carolina now, you've got people pointing fingers at each other. And again, contextually, this was a 1979 yearbook. Governor Northrum's, I believe, was 84. The governor, the attorney general, I think, was 1980. I mean, so that's the time period. And, you know, I'm a historian as well as being a political reporter, and I probably appreciate context more than anyone. But I also am a firmly committed to the idea that the phrase "we need to move past this" is not meaningless. I think that it needs to be corrected. It needs to be called out. You know, I'll be perfectly, my personal honest opinion is the top four officials of Virginia's government need to resign. And then whatever Virginia's constitution calls for whoever takes over the reins of government, needs to be that person. And hopefully that person hasn't done something ignorant. But I think we've gotten to the stage where, you know, accountability has got to be there. If anything, the Trump era has taught me as a journalist is that he pulled a scab off of the deep wound in American culture, which is the elephant in the room, and that is racism.
Right.
You know, if there's anything that you want to blame the Americans for, that would be number one on my list. You know, so
well,
I think
and
again,
the,
without
the
beating
thing,
a dead horse, but I think that's what needs to happen. You know.
Yeah. The thing with Virginia is they could take a page out of the Nixon playbook on this because Nixon wasn't the only one with scandal. Spiro Agnew, his vice president, was also plagued by it. And what they did was Spiro Agnew resigned first, got replaced. Then Nixon got replaced.
Resigned.
You know, so, I mean, Virginia could take this a little bit methodically and move through so that all four resignations don't have to happen on the same day. And so that they
I'm not advocating for that. I'm just simply saying though, you know, mind you, three of Virginia's former governors, two of whom are now the U.S. Senators, Tim Kaine and Mark Warner, you know, are saying this, you know, we can't have this. Okay. And it really has, it's gotten to the point, you know, where we can't have this. And this was going to segue actually me into a conversation that I thought was kind of interesting, that I thought was going to bring up tonight. The number two man in charge of California's National Guard, Major General Matt Beavers, was testifying on Tuesday before the General Assembly's Veteran Affairs Committee. And he basically told lawmakers in Sacramento that the California Guard was going to defy the Trump administration's ban on transgender military personnel. And I'm quoting the general: "As long as you fight, we don't care what gender you identify as," he said. Now, mind you, this is a month after the 5-4 decision from the Supreme Court, which essentially undid three of the states. It hasn't undone the fourth one in Maryland, so the ban obviously hasn't been taking effect yet. Okay, but you know, the thing is that what the general was basically saying is, okay, and I'm quoting him, "I believe the ban will be lifted again." Okay, he also made note to lawmakers that there's two openly trans airmen serving in the National Air Guard, but he acknowledged there are more, but that the guard does not count them. And then he said to the lawmakers, "At the end of the day, we're not compelled to measure it, so we don't." Now,
right.
The reason I'm bringing this up and segueing it in is because this is reflecting changes in attitudes, you know, and again, Trump's ban is not something that even the military really wanted to start with, okay? But it also reflects, I think, a larger change in society where people are beginning to understand that, you know, preconceived notions and preconceived ideas and so-called Christian morals, because, you know, I will put the lipstick on that pig, it's what it is not applicable, okay, in terms of things like force readiness, in terms of, you know, people being able, you know, to do their jobs. I mean, if you'll know,
right.
Well, you didn't watch, you didn't want to, but at the State of the Union address, okay, the Transgender Military Service Committee, or community, I'm sorry, not committee, community was extremely well represented, okay, because as guests of sitting lawmakers in the audience, you had four highly respected individuals that are transgender, have had marvelous service to their country, okay, and at the end of the day, they are the living embodiments, okay, of the fact that being trans has nothing to do with it. Let me say this, Rob. Let me say this. Leadership and bravery are defined by character. Abraham Lincoln once said, "Character is like a tree and a reputation like its shadow. The shadow is what we think of. The tree is the real thing." And with that, I would like to, you know, give recognition to Army Major Ian Brown, Navy Lieutenant Commander Blake M. Dremmen, Army Captain Jennifer Pace, U.S. Air Force Staff Sergeant Logan Ireland, and Navy Information Technologist Petty Officer Second Class Megan Winters. These were four of the several that were in the audience, two enlisted and three officers. And they, you know, if you look at them and you see pictures of them in uniform, I mean, Rob, these people have a chest full of, you know, medals and ribbons and accommodations, you know, and they prove the point. So this goes back to not only what the California Army National Guard General said, but, you know, the fact is, okay, you know, we've got to get, I think, as a culture and a society, past the point where these prejudices and these antiquated ideas and these incorrect ideas about people and capabilities and humanity, you know, are gone. I mean, you know, you and I've talked to our dear friend of the show, Bryn Tannehill, who was a former U.S. Navy aviator, and, you know, Commander Tannehill can tell you, you know, being trans does not have an effect on military readiness or the ability to be able to do one's job, okay? So I think at the end of the day, that's really part of it. It's kind of like the racism issue. So anyway, let me get off the soapbox.
Well, no. I was like, I had a few points in there about 5 minutes ago. No. It's a ridiculous, stupid, idiotic premise in the very first place. I mean, there's no logic to it. And obviously it's been forced on the military. They haven't been enforcing it. Apparently some lawmakers are now crafting legislation to fight it. Nobody wants it. And, there's a good chance that it won't see light of day. And even as when we talked to Shannon Mittner about it, there's not even a lot of teeth in it itself. It doesn't, people who are out and trans, like all the individuals that you mentioned that showed up at Congress, mm-hmm. Are not ones in danger of being exercised through even the trans ban because they're already out. And so it which is, again, a nonsensical thing, because why would people who are already out be more ready for combat than people who are trans that don't happen to be out? I mean, it's just the stupidest thing in the whole world.
It is. And now on that point, let me go ahead. Potentially.
No, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was going to point out that Washington Blade international editor and political correspondent Michael Labors wrote today that a group of bipartisan lawmakers have introduced bills that will allow openly transgender people to not only enlist in the military, but protect trans service members who are already in. U.S. Representatives Jackie Speier of California, Joe Kennedy of Massachusetts, John Cato of New York, Susan Davis, also California, and Anthony Brown of Maryland introduced House Resolution 1032. At the same time, U.S. Senators Kristen Gillibrand of New York, Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, Jack Reed, Democrat of Rhode Island, introduced an identical bill in the U.S. Senate. And I'm going to read from what Michael wrote here, Representative Spears, and I'm quoting, "Our transgender service members put their lives on the line every day despite an ill-advised edict from the president. This bill makes it clear to our brave transgender troops that we see them and that we honor the risks they take and the sacrifices that they and their families make for the safety of our country. It is also solid common sense. The president's ban is not only hateful, it's un-American. It harms military readiness and morale and ultimately makes our country less strong."
I think the thing to be grateful for is that as this stupid ignorance has reared its head, and we all know it's being driven down by Mike Pence in particular, that mm-hmm. it is getting its own form of backlash through all different factions from the military, from the legislature, et cetera. So hopefully it will reinforce something that people were, through Obama, a little bit uncomfortable with, and really put the momentum towards transgender rights going in the right direction. I wanted to ask you, though, Brody,
Go ahead.
Yeah, since you had the painful task of listening to and examining the State of the Union, one of the things that Trump was reported to have talked about, which on the face sounds like a really progressive, positive thing, is his intention to end HIV, which would be an incredibly wonderful thing for a stable genius to actually go do. What is your take on that? How does he plan to do it? How is Mike Pence on board? And what is this all about?
Well, the administration, through Health and Human Services, wanted to do a push on to really move the goalposts much closer in ending the scourge of HIV. Now, ironically, today, which was National Black HIV AIDS Awareness Day, there was a meeting at Health and Human Services yesterday, and virtually everybody sitting in the room was white. The other part of the problem is that community groups, you know, Black AIDS activist groups, other activist groups, are saying that, you know, in order to have an effective end to the HIV epidemic, there are two things, or actually three things, that need to be accomplished. And that's confronting racism, it's confronting homophobia, it is providing outreach to transgender women of color in particular, it's providing proper sexual education, and most importantly, it's providing access to HIV treatment and prevention. Now, none of that has been embraced by this administration, virtually none of it. So he can stand on the dais and say, well, you know, we're going to end HIV and this and that and the other thing, but your own administration isn't doing anything, okay, that would assist in this. Consider the administration is doing all it can to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, which includes pharmaceuticals, which include the very necessary pharmaceuticals needed for the treatment and prevention, or even PrEP, okay? We'll start with that. Then we've got the administration attacking not just the trans military personnel, but trans people in general, okay? And I'm going to underline the real danger for trans women of color and trans men of color, but particularly the women, both Black and Latino, or Latina, my apologies, ladies, Latina, okay? So they're wrapping all this in a package, and Trump is standing up there saying that we're going to do all this and we're going to have it ended and everything else. And, yeah, you know, you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. And, you know, to your
What did he propose they're going to do? I agree with you that they're doing everything that would not only not end HIV, but shut down progress that has already been made in curtailing it. So what, I mean, and I'm honestly asking, I'm not trying to pick him apart. I'm really in earnest asking, what in his imagination does he think they're doing or going to do that will end HIV? Or was this a ridiculous claim, like standing up saying, we're going to end cancer?
Well, it was ridiculous. I mean, let me illustrate the point. At the end of last year in 2017, okay, the number of members on the Presidential Advisory Committee on HIV/AIDS, okay, or PACHA, was zero. Why? Because six people resigned in protest of Trump's policies. Then, at the end of December of 2017, wait for it, okay, the president terminated the remaining 16 members via letter delivered by FedEx.
Right.
So all of 2018, there was no members of this committee. And this is the committee that would actually construct the policy, working in conjunction with the National Institutes of Health, Health and Human Services, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, and the outreach efforts of virtually every major state, you know, HIV and AIDS, you know, program out there. So you've got zero people, okay? Now suddenly, okay, Health and Human Services on December 7th is posting an announcement that this PACHA committee will meet on March 14 and 15, okay? And in that news release that was put out there, oh, the council will discuss recommendations regarding programs, policies, and research to promote effective prevention, treatment, and cure of HIV disease and AIDS. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Okay, yeah, that's all fine and good. There's one small problem with that. Okay, how can you have a meeting if you don't have any bodies?
Well, that's
now
my question.
Now suddenly the push in. Yeah, well, that's just it. And now the push on, of course, is to fill that up, which was part of the reason for the meeting yesterday. not to be a cynical journalist, but there's nothing that they can do. Okay. Medical sciences have already shown. Go ahead, Rob. go ahead.
I'm trying to get everything you're saying. I get every reason why it's what he's saying. His record is the exact opposite in spades. What I'm trying to get to is, for a minute, not giving him the benefit of the doubt, but just in his imagination, what are they planning or thinking they might do? I mean, is this, agreed, this meeting is ridiculous without a committee, and they're going to put a committee together. Who do you think is going to be on that committee? Will it be people that are of the caliber of the people who left previously? And what do you imagine? Let's just give them the credit that they're going to do something. What do you think they're going to do that in their minds will end HIV?
I'll be perfectly honest with you. Okay, first of all, it's too early in the game. Okay. We don't have a full advisory committee. The other part of this is that the administration has been devastating the budget, and especially in areas that deal with prevention. Okay. So, I'm not sure what they hope to accomplish, because like I said, you've got him saying one thing, but the actuality is something completely different.
Right.
So I honestly can't answer that question. I mean, it's a good question. It's a solid question. And I do think it's a question that needs to be asked and asked repeatedly. But as long as you've got an administration that nakedly and openly displays transphobia, homophobia, racist attitudes, you're never going to get anything done, especially not when it's busy cutting integral parts of the budget that would fund these critical programs. You can talk about ending AIDS all you want, but if you don't have the money in the budget to confront the issue, to give proper research, to give proper funding to the people that are on the front lines of the battle, what good is it going to do? They've actually cut back on some of the money for existing programs that are already there. You know, by the skin of the teeth, certain programs were able to get refunded, like the Ryan White Act, but there were critical programs that NIH and CDC runs. They didn't get funding.
Right.
So it's like, how are you supposed to do this if you're not going to, do anything about it? And here's the most important thing, okay? You cannot talk about HIV, AIDS prevention. You cannot talk about a cure. You cannot talk about even maintaining control of this horrible disease until you start talking about educating people as to the causes of it, what happens with it, how to prevent it, needle exchanges, sexual education classes, all the things that Republicans do not like to talk about. You can't sit there and talk about abstinence. You have to have people that work in the Black community and the Latino communities going in there and having these conversations, and they're tough conversations, but you can't avoid them. You're not going to succeed unless you do this. And the last three administrations got that. Okay. The Bush administration poured a ton of money into HIV and AIDS prevention in Africa. Okay. You saw what the Obama administration did. This administration has been so busy cutting money out of various programs. And then you've got the other part of it. Okay. And that's when you get into talking about, programs that educate, especially youth. These people believe that abstinence is the holy grail. Okay. I'm sorry. This is all the influences of your conservative organizations and, quite frankly, your Christian crazies like the Family Research Council. And I got news for them. They got their heads up their posterior. Okay?
Right.
So there's some real problems with this, serious problems with this. In other words,
do you think,
on a Pinocchio scale, yeah, that was a Pinocchio. Big nose.
Well, do you think it's a Pinocchio, or do you think that Mike Pence has something – a little darker, a la the trans ban, in mind that they're going to come out and, attack basically gay sex or sexual practices as being HIV threats to public safety and trying to do something to recriminalize homosexual behavior.
Well, you know, that's the thing that they keep trying, and that's the thing that they like. Fortunately, the truth of the matter is, and I've been speaking to people from the Williams Institute in Los Angeles. I've had conversations with Nate Silver's 538 people, Gallup. We've been looking at polling numbers. We've been looking at studies being done by the various universities, and the vast majority of Americans do not want to see any kind of sexual practices recriminalized. They see it as pointless.
Right.
Most Americans also do not believe, okay, that being transgender is something that needs to be criminalized and it's something that needs to be excluded. You're talking about a very small population of Christian crazies. But the problem is, while they are a minority, they're extremely influential, they're extremely powerful, and more importantly, they control the politics and the money of the Republican Party. And I'm not talking about Trump's base now. I'm talking about the people that, you know, support people like Mitch McConnell. So there is a problem there. It's the same driving force that during the State of the Union, you know, he talked about late-term abortion and that nonsense, and that, quite frankly, is another Pinocchio. So, you know, at the end of the day, yes, people like Pence and his, you know, associates and minions and supporters are problematic. The reality is, with a now democratically controlled House, with a Senate that has started to shake out, you know, some of the more nonsensical rubbish, I don't think the administration is really, quite frankly, going to be able to do that. However, that said, there's still a matter of local governments and local jurisdictions, and the Christian crazies are still very much in control of them, and they will continue to be a problem. Texas is the poster child for that, followed by probably, I would say, Mississippi and Arkansas. But, you know, these are things that are probably more problematic from the standpoint that the one thing that Trump has succeeded at, okay, and McConnell has succeeded at, they haven't been able to govern, they haven't been able to do anything, but there's one thing they have done, and it's probably the most dangerous thing possible to democracy as far as human and civil rights go. They've loaded the courts, okay, with people that think like that.
Right.
And right. That is going to be a long, long fight, okay? And there's going to be cases where that's going to get really ugly. But, you know, I don't think that they would love, you know, they have a dream list. They'd like to, you know, recriminalize, you know, what they call a lifestyle and behavior and all that other nonsense. But the reality is that the numbers aren't there. The American public isn't behind it. They're not going to succeed. So really the only venue they've got left to make life miserable, not only for women's reproductive rights, but for minority groups, including the trans and the lesbian, gay, and queer and intersex communities, is going to be through the courts, and it's going to be in areas such as work, housing, medical care, things like that. That's where it's going to be most problematic. And unfortunately, that's been the worst effect of this administration. Quite frankly, is they've been putting these nutcases on the court, and they even put two on the high court. So it's going to be problematic at best, Rob. But no,
right.
To answer your question,
right.
No.
And we should note that right before we went on the air tonight, Supreme Court kind of handed an interesting surprise regarding Louisiana's abortion law by not upholding it and. At least for now, signaling that the Supreme Court does not intend to do much reversing of Roe versus Wade. And also an interesting point that the swing vote on this one was
Chief Justice
Supreme
Roberts.
Chief Justice Roberts, which you and I had discussed before about him potentially stepping up into that swing role. And it looks like we may be correct that he might be doing that.
I think the reason, again, a chief justice traditionally is always worried about the legacy of the court because it bears their name. Rehnquist, Berger, Warren, Roberts, it's all the same. They really do worry about the legacy of the court because they put their own stamp on the court. And I think that Roberts is looking at the court and realizing, with particularly Gorsuch being a literalist, Kavanaugh a little more to the far right, Thomas and Alioto definitely being right, that there's got to be some sort of balance in the five-person majority. And I think that the Chief Justice is probably also looking, you know, at his legacy and trying to make the determination of where to go with it. Plus, here's the other thing. They don't live in a vacuum. And the High Court is more than critically aware of the current political temperature of the United States. And I think that the High Court, you know, as evidenced by the fact, you will notice that only, okay, out of 9 justices, 4 of them showed up for the State of the Union address. That's rather telling. Okay. That signals, okay, the fact that they understand, okay, and I think that that was a very public statement the court sent. You know, there wasn't all 9 there. There was only 4 of them, including the Chief Justice. But, you know, it was sending a message, okay? And that message is, okay, that they are starting to look at, really, we don't want to be to that political. Remember, Kavanaugh went through an extremely bruising confirmation process that's probably going to damage him for a while. Gorsuch, you know, is the, you know, the usurper, the thief. Okay, because the Democrats see him being in a seat that rightfully should have gone to Chief Judge of the D.C. Supreme Court, Merrick Garland, you know, and they look at McConnell as, you know, a seat stealer and Gorsuch being the recipient of the seat stealing. So the court is starting to look at it a little bit differently than we thought they would.
Since I wasn't there, obviously, because I avoided it.
Yeah.
Who is the conservative justice who didn't show up? If Robert showed up, and there are 4 others, who was the one that didn't show?
Thomas.
Thomas. Ah. Okay.
I didn't see Thomas.
So,
I didn't see Thomas.
Yeah. That is all very interesting, actually.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to segue because we want to touch on a couple things before we end tonight. What is this young person who is intersex, who is fighting for the practice of assigning kids who are born intersex at birth a gender? Very interesting.
What I think is really critically important about that is that that young person from a very early age knew that there was a disconnect in the way that they were physically put together, that, you know, there was more to it. They also had both sets of genders, you know, traits, and from an early age, they decided that, you know, they wanted to make a difference in changing that, and with the support of the parents, and I have to give the mother in particular props for this, they went out and have, you know, really done, I think, an excellent job of not only informing people as to the fact that, you know, intersex is a variant of the human condition, but that it's not something that, you know, the medical profession needs to make a decision on. And the point to this, and I think it's a valid one, is that the doctors should not be making these decisions. I think these are decisions that should be made by the parents and at a time that is appropriate by the child. Okay. I think that, you know, and before that, of course, was never the case. There was always the the arbitrary, decision being made, and the doctor would, literally assign a gender, and that was the end of it. And later on in life, of course, then there had been very well documented situations where assigned genders weren't correct. So
in many of the cases. Yeah, that's the thing. It is, and that's the thing that makes it really a horrendous practice, is that it is likely that when they make an assignment, the fact that they're making an assignment is going to be wrong, because that person's biology is already this more gender fluid place. And so any decision in the binary is likely to be a mistake. It is, in my mind, it is a horrendous practice. It is one of the cruelest, most horrible things that the medical profession, albeit, naively doing, has done. So that's why I applaud this so strongly, is that, this is, in my mind, up there with reparative therapy and conversion therapy and all that. Mm-hmm. On a psychological level of where at least in this case, the people who were doing it, like I said, from a place of naivete rather than outright oppression. But again, it's like that idea that one, that they just physically clean up the person to resemble one gender or the other, that they have done, that's fine, that person will grow in that way, which makes no sense. I just think this is hugely important to the people that it'll involve.
I would say that, in this particular instance, I have to give props to Christina Turner and her child Ori, and the work that Ori and Christina are doing to educate the medical community in particular as to the danger of this practice, and educate the medical community towards reconsideration. There are doctors now who get it, but sadly there are not enough doctors that really do understand it. And I think that's what Kathleen Turner and Ori are doing in terms of education is so incredibly important. And it is, as you said, it's something that needs to happen. I think it comes down to a matter of basic human dignity and respect. An acknowledgement of individuality. And I think that is not something that should be arbitrarily abrogated by a physician.
Absolutely. And speaking of human dignity and acceptance, et cetera, the Biden Foundation has teamed up with LGBTQ groups on what they're calling a family acceptance campaign. What can you tell us about that, Brody?
The Family Acceptance Campaign is the brainchild of the Biden Foundation in Delaware. And one of the things that they're working towards, and they did this with some meetings they did on Capitol Hill last week, is to get parents and families of transgender kids to understand the dynamics of what things are going on with their children, the support that they can give their children, the types of issues that they are going to be confronting, what they need to do, how to address it, everything from bullying to misgendering. Immediate family members may be accepting of their transgender children, but the grandparents may not, or the uncles and the aunts or the cousins. So what the aim of the program is to get families proactively involved in accepting the kids for who they are and their gender identification. And I think that's kind of a critical and important thing, because a lot of times the largest problem we have with our trans youth is that they're not accepted by their own families. And that's really where the base of a lot of the problems come from, because if they lose that platform, that foundation, that support, you know, it becomes very difficult, if next to impossible, for them to be able to function.
No, I don't think people understand that this is not a feel-good kind of thing. This is vital. This is absolutely vital. They have done studies where kids who grow up trans who are not supported by their immediate family or their family or their support group or, you know, that circle around them, they fall into a category of about a 70% suicide attempt rate for that group.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas kids who have grown up and in these modern times, there are more and more of them where the child is listened to early on, the parents take corrective action to
mm-hmm.
properly genderize their child, family and the circle around them are supportive, and those kids are not only not in that 70 percentile of suicide attempt rate, they go down to a normal rate, the normal rate as any other kids growing up. And that is astounding. That is, you know, that is so important, you know, to save lives.
Well,
I mean, it's life or death.
It's just critical. Yeah, it is. And Nikki Mushevic, who is the executive director of the Movement Advancement Project, which is an LGBTQ think tank who's partnering with the Gender Spectrum and the Advancing Acceptance Campaign and the Biden Foundation, said this. I'm going to quote, okay? "It is critical for families to know that their words and actions can make the difference between a happy, healthy, thriving child or one at greatly elevated risk of depression, suicidal behaviors, and other harmful outcomes. Too many families and the lives of too many transgender children have been devastated by parents who reject these children or try to force them to be someone that they're not." As you know, and I guess I'm telling my listeners out there, my former wife is a pediatric surgeon, and she gets the Journal of Pediatrics. It's just, you know, being an MD, she gets that. And there was research that was published.
Yeah, I got to cut you off because we are out of time. So we'll have to save the addendum. So your quote was beautiful, and we're going to end it there. Thank you all for listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We will be back here again next week at the same time, and you can listen to the podcast anytime. Also, listen to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com. That is Saturday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. I want to thank Brody for his brilliance again, yet again, and everything that you do. We are all the better for it. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. We appreciate you very, very much. Your comments and feedback are incredibly welcome. And you can follow us on Twitter on @RatedLGBT. And we will talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.